Yes, we know those home guys.
We heard about some of it. Okay, let's call it to order. Late start. Yes. Approval of the agenda.
I make a motion to approve the agenda.
As modified.
As written. Because we didn't have anything.
Did you have?
Second.
It's been modified though. It's yours modified.
Yes.
With Anne moving up the.
Oh yeah, you're going to approve the amendment.
Oh no, this has been, oh, we're approving the minutes of the agenda.
The agenda first.
Oh, okay.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended.
Yes, I make a motion.
I'll still second.
Okay, great.
I'll let you slide.
And the minutes, approval of the minutes.
That's why you had the squirt gun.
I approve the minutes. I second it.
Good.
I need to go get my glasses.
And the old business, do we have any old business? I don't think we do.
No.
Okay.
Oh, now back on the hot seat. Okay.
Take
hot seat we are.
Anne has applied to join the Board of Adjustment, I think. Does everybody know?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody know Anne, so this is our opportunity to interview her. If anyone's got any questions they'd like to ask, Ken, if you've got anything you want to say first.
You previously served, right? You did this before, right?
Yes, I did. I had to take just a little bit of leave of absence to help with the family matters, but now I'm ready to get back in. And I guess the main thing that I want to say, because I know the Board of Adjustments has its moments and people question it, but I really am a believer and really do respect the law. And I understand why certain laws are put in place for all of us so we can continue to grow reasonably and thoughtfully, planfully. And it's just not arbitrary and capricious what we're doing. There's a set rule and regulation, and we're there to help people do things in a safe manner. And when people come in for variances, it can get very emotional. And as long as we can help people just understand, or at least that's the role I always see myself in, is help someone understand this is not a personal emotional. This is very black and white. And these are the rules, and these are why the rules are created. So I feel very comfortable. I enjoy working with the books. I enjoy looking at the laws. And I enjoy looking at other ways to view the laws, as we have done when we had, in previous cases, when we had situations where someone was appealing based purely on emotion related to a handicap ramp and requesting the variance that way. Well, fortunately, I know the laws regarding it. I was on the ADA committee, and we just like point. And it was take the emotion out, and let's just figure out where we can go from here. I feel I can be an asset, and I'm ready to get back involved as long as it's not past 9 o'clock. Because I fall asleep. And I will bring you ducks each and every time. Yes. You will always get a duck gift from me. I mean, that is something I'll do. I am no nonsense, but I also like to have fun, and I like to definitely participate in what's going on in Kerry Beach.
I have to advise the board members not to take the gifts into consideration.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a surprise.
Well, come on. I am on the hot seat. You do have that boa breathing down there. Yes.
She had my boat with the Snickers.
Oh, actually, those were mine.
Oh, yeah.
I have to keep you all.
If I can interject here for a second. I was on the board just a few years before Ann came on, and when she did, there were many questions that we had with the American Disability Act, and her knowledge of that subject really helped in our making many decisions when it came to the handicap ramps or those kind of things, and that's a lot of what we do. he would get a little out of hand. We enjoyed that because everybody picked on Charlie. I respect her highly with her knowledge and what she's been able to do for us in the past.
And hopefully continue to do in the future. Thank you very much.
No questions for me?
And if you do have questions, please feel free to call me. I'm right around the corner, as we just discussed earlier. We have those smartphones. You can text me. I can respond back.
It's usually outside cleaning the pool or something.
Yeah, yes. Yes. Yes, and yeah. I always do get demerits for my pool. Because it doesn't quite fit that variance, but...
Anybody got any other questions?
I don't have any questions.
Okay. We get to vote while you're here?
No. I'm going. Bye.
Good to see you again.
It's great to see you. And seriously, if you do think of something else, just don't hesitate. But I do apologize. I cannot stay tonight, so you get the extra.
We're going to have a heavy dose of law if you want to stick around.
I had prior to commitments when they were called. And, yeah.
And I know you got to be
careful. I really do fall asleep at 9 o'clock. But then again, I'm up at 4. You're more than welcome to join me that
night. No. Thanks, too early.
Thank you so very much. Thanks. Nice to see you.
Okay.
Any discussions before we take a motion?
It's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, same with me.
Seasoned veterans.
Yeah, she's done it. She's smart. She uses her head instead of her heart, and I think she'll be an asset to us. Yeah. And of course, you know, she really is trained. She's been to several training sessions already. So I would like to make a motion to accept her.
I'll second that.
All right. So this now goes to Anita.
Okay, take a vote. Unanimous?
Unanimous, okay. Yes. Aye.
Okay. Then we will recommend to council that we be confirmed as a member.
Okay. Great.
And we're still looking for two alternates. Mm-hmm. Anybody at all? Now, normally we have people lined up, but the last few years it's been tough.
Must be making some rough decisions, and nobody wants to know.
Okay.
Let's
and we can
just move on.
Continue with our agenda.
Go on to the training.
I'll take that, Chairman, if you'd like.
Go ahead.
I put together a pretty detailed presentation. Some of it's light, some of it's detailed. I did that because I thought it had been. I didn't realize that you had the experience that you've had, which is good. So what we'll do instead, we'll go through the PowerPoint. It's just simple and entertaining. And then we're going to walk through some handouts. We'll skim those more than I had originally anticipated, but you'll always get something new from it. So it'll be helpful, and we won't be as detailed as I thought. First thing I would say is BOA can be interpreted lots of different ways. Bank of America, fashion accessory, but I've always liked that concept. And really, when you're doing a quasi-judicial hearing, you've got to get yourself all around the evidence and digest it and make a point, so there is some relevance to it. Again, this was geared for participants that never had any BOA experience. It's unlike a quasi-judicial, rezonings and annexations and text amendments, those are legislative decisions. And because they're legislative decisions, they're extremely hard to successfully appeal. If I come in for a rezoning and I'm denied, and I can take that to court, but because it's legislative, it is very, very difficult for me to prevail. It basically has to end up being an arbitrary and capricious decision. And that's what a public hearing is. And I'm sure you all have had public hearings like that where all kinds of emotions run high. And a good example was the vacation home rental ordinance. It went very well, but fascinating meeting. This place was standing room only. In contrast, quasi-judicial hearings are evidentiary. You know that you have to take the evidence and based on that evidence make findings of fact and reach conclusions. A good example of that is I have done and still do a lot of civil litigation. And before I had that experience, I just assumed that the judge makes a judgment and that's what it is. Rather, if we have a trial and I win, the judge is going to ask me to prepare a judgment. But that judgment is 12, 15 pages long for even fairly simple cases. And the first part are findings of fact. And then the second part are conclusions of law. And at the end, you have your judgment. And that's basically what you have to do. I've done a lot of quasi-judicial hearings. And I've appealed them to the North Carolina appellate system. I've done that for private landowners and developers, and I also represent Carolina Shores and Belleville, so I've done that as their attorney. My one anecdote kind of sums it up best. I was in front of New Hanover County Board of Adjustment, and somebody wanted to open a daycare center on a busy road. And that wasn't the problem. It was the gated community right across from the proposed daycare center site that didn't want it. So, and they were well-schooled, and they had put together a good case. But it was all layman opinions. It wasn't expert opinions. So I did what I did under the quasi-judicial format, and the best complaint I heard was when one of the opponents got up and said to the board, "Mr. Eldridge is trying to make this into a trial," and that is really what a quasi-judicial hearing is. It's much more of a trial than a public hearing. Not quite all the way a trial, but it's pretty darn close. You use them for special use permits, administrative zoning decisions, basically, which can run the gamut from a citation to an opinion to an interpretation. Somebody asks John if he can do so-and-so, and John writes a letter saying, no, basically under our ordinance you can't. That decision can be appealed, quasi-judicial. Variances, you know a little bit about them. That's your statute. It's gone through some changes in the years. It's 4 or 5 pages long. Someday you might want to print it out. I didn't bring a copy of it. I've got pieces of it. But I commend it to your reading. It's pretty interesting. If you like that kind of stuff, as a lawyer, I find it interesting. Special use permits code, your all's code. I looked through that code pretty hard, and I didn't find too many references to the Board of Adjustment. As far as I can tell, you all handle variances and appeals because council handles special use permits. Mm-hmm. Administrative appeals, you all hear that here. Variances, you all hear that here. We'll talk more about those in a minute. One of the recent amendments to that statute is they adjusted. There used to be supermajority for several types of decisions. Now it's supermajority only for variances and a majority vote for appeals. That's a recent change. How to do it? These are really the crux of a quasi-judicial hearing. You've got, and if you can remember these cornerstones, they'll guide you instinctually whenever you have difficult decisions to make in the course of a hearing. First one is, what makes quasi-judicial hearings different is due process. I don't really know how it evolved, but the bottom line is that if somebody's looking to appeal a citation or wants a variance or a special use permit, the property interests are such that the law has developed to give the applicant or the appellate due process rights. And in this case, due process rights certainly includes notice, but it basically boils down to the opportunity to be heard and the opportunity to present evidence. And that is really the cornerstone of a quasi-judicial hearing. The other thing is that, well, the other main component of due process is impartiality, meaning that the decisions can only be based on the evidence and nothing else. And there's all kinds of little wrinkles to that. I've seen academic materials that suggest that, let's say you're going to handle a variance. The ideal scenario is you come into the hearing without any, you've got a clean slate up there. You don't have any predisposed opinions. You can't have a predisposed opinion anyway unless you can also be impartial and open to change. But I've seen academic materials that suggest that on your own time, going by the subject property and studying it, or going out certainly and making measurements and all that kind of stuff, you're doing your homework on your own. You're forming opinions on your own. You're not listening in a neutral capacity to somebody bringing that evidence to you. That's sort of what that's talking about. I find it very interesting, and you all may want to do this from time to time. It sounds like you know what you're doing on your quasi-judicials, and I'm telling you, and this is not a criticism, because, and I'm sure you all will agree, most public bodies, those members, whatever their level of sophistication, try very hard to do the people's business. It's pretty impressive. I always tell people, if they want to see what democracy is really like, go to your local government hearings and your local government meetings. But nonetheless, some of this stuff is hard to grasp. And it's very interesting to see how different boards handle quasi-judicial situations. I've had a couple of instances where, with very careful training, with black and white stuff in front of them, they still really had to wrestle with what they were doing. They just didn't get it. It didn't sink. Again, listening to you all prior to this item on the agenda, it sounds like you all do get it. Fair play. We're back to due process. Fair and impartial hearing. Don't discuss the case or gather evidence prior to. Like anything else in local government, don't vote if you have impermissible conflicts. Sometimes you'll see in a hearing, particularly if the applicant or appellant is represented by counsel, I've seen scenarios where they're actually polled in some sense by the party's attorney just to make sure that it was a clean slate. Sometimes maybe they have an inkling.
We do that at the beginning of our hearing. We ask if there's any conflict. Each one states yes or no.
Good, very good, very good. So just remember, in a quasi-judicial hearing, you are both the judge and the jury. And that's another good example. If I have a jury trial, the judge only decides issues of law and the jury decides issues of fact. If I have a bench trial, the judge wears both hats. In this case, you're wearing both hats. Another thing that's pretty, well, and again, your comments tell me that you're familiar with this. You can take a BOA decision directly to Superior Court, which sits and reviews your proceedings, just like the Court of Appeals sits and reviews a local court decision. And what they're looking, they're not going to take any new evidence. But what happens is you do a writ of certiorari, the order is granted, granting certiorari, which means the judge is going to review it. The parties, basically it's the attorneys, they get together and they spend a month or two getting the record in place. They give that to the court, and then another month or two goes by when they're doing their briefs, and then they go in and argue. And that's what the appeal at on the next level up is all about. No new evidence, no witnesses. It's all based on the record. So with that in mind, and just to further your education by getting a couple of nuggets of information from these attacks, Josie, got one for you if you want it. Let's look at how the statute, which is 168-388, is the BOA statute. Let's look at how they deal with appeals. This is directly from the statute. We're not going to go through it in great detail, but there's some interesting aspects to this. You can hear and decide appeals from administrative officials charged with enforcing the zoning ordinance. One question, and go to number one, a person who has standing under 393D or the city may appeal a decision to the Board of Adjustment. A lot of people don't realize that Kiri Beach could take a PZC decision. Let's say PZC actually decides special use permits and not council. Council could direct Kiri Beach to file a BOA appeal of that SUP, of that special use permit decision. 393D is a reference to who has standing to take a quasi-judicial hearing to Superior Court for a certiorari review. You don't need to know that, but what I want to point out on 393D is one of the hard things, and this would be more akin to a variance. In administrative appeal, you just get the facts and you figure whether they violated the ordinance or whether the interpretation is right or wrong. That's black and white. With a variance, and particularly with a special use permit, you're going to have the neighbors come in. And Joe Blow might want a variance from the setback requirements, and Mary Smith that lives right next to him is just obsessed with how close his back deck's going to be to her property. So you have the hearing. Joe Blow presents his case. Mary wants to participate in the hearing. She thinks she's got standing. And without going into a lot of detail, standing is you have to have a substantial interest as a property owner, and in some cases you have to incur special damages, which is more than monetary damages, to have standing. That's something for the court to figure out down the line, but you may be presented with that situation in the course of a hearing when a neighbor wants to participate. Remember, these aren't public hearings. You don't let everybody get up and comment. It's only for the participants. We will address that issue when it comes up, but suffice it to say that you would ask that would-be participant a few questions to determine if they had that interest or not. You've got the power to say, no, you can't participate, but really the best advice is if they make out some sort of a case for having the right to participate, err on the side of caution and let them participate. There's no downside to you. If that person had standing, whether that person had standing is an issue, will happen when they go up to the Superior Court. That judge will take care of that issue. It doesn't hurt you, but at the same to allow that participation, but at the same time, you want to guard against just having the public or members of the public as a whole come in. Let's say it's a special use permit for a daycare center, and you've got people living in phase four of a subdivision where only phase one is across the street. That's a difficult question whether the only people that are going to speak about in opposition are way back there. They don't really have the same interest involved as the people that actually front the street. So we'll spend more time on that if it ever becomes an issue. Back to appeals, and Josie, this is a lot of this stuff is for staff. If I'm going to appeal, I'm going to get a written notice about the decision. I've got 30 days to file that appeal. Now look, number three is real interesting because number four is how they deal with it. I had to defend a client from a BOA, from an appeal made to BOA. The decision that the very disruptive neighbor was appealing was made in December. He did not file the appeal until April. And you look at this and you say, well, my God, that's 120 days, not 30 days. But you, this comes right out of the statute. You look at the second sentence of 3. Any other person who is standing shall have 30 days from the receipt of any actual notice. That neighbor wasn't in the notice chain, so they didn't get any written confirmation of the decision. He just happened to go by planning one day, learned about the decision, and filed the appeal. Well, I made a big stink that it was 120 days, but that second sentence is what he was allowed to have his hearing. Yeah, he was allowed to have his hearing. But if you look at 4, now nobody will do 4, but 4 is the solution to that. If you really get your act together, you can post a sign about zoning decision or subdivision decision in letters at least 6 inches high and identifying the means to contact an official for information. This is called constructive notice. If you, number 4 talks about putting some signs out. If you put those signs out, the 30-day clock runs constructively from the date you post those signs. So if the signs had existed in that neighbor's case, he would have been out of luck. The official, John, would have to give, number 5, give a complete record to the board, including exhibits. You all may or may not know this, but I'm cited. I've got a $100 a day penalty. Each day is a new offense. After 5 days, I'm in the hole for $500. The minute I file my appeal, that's frozen. It doesn't add up anymore until it's all said and done. And you'd be surprised. I had a street closing case in Wilmington. Not going to tell you the whole story, but let's just say this, that the street closing concept was presented to a violator of parking his RV in the wrong place who had accumulated, I'm not kidding, $48,000 worth of fines. Well, somebody knew somebody knew somebody, and the facts were such that when all the somebodies got together, they basically said, we can fix this problem for you. We're going to close that street, makes it a corner lot. Your RV's okay. And by the way, if you plant these 6 shrubs and keep the pavement clean that we closed, we'll forget about the $48,000. And they did forget about that $48,000 right up the road. But I didn't tell you that story. On the second page, basically just talks about you can reverse or affirm wholly or partly or may modify the decision that the administrative official made, and then from there he can appeal it to the court. Variances.
Well, you got the keys. What's the role of, we sometimes have an attorney here.
Yeah, that's a great question.
And sometimes we don't. They don't seem to perform a representative role. They're more of an advisory role and just another witness almost.
Well, you've raised a great point, a very, very good point. I'm glad you raised it because I had thought of it earlier and it slipped my mind. And let's broaden that a little bit. Normally, if I have we're staff. Let's say she's the planner and I'm the town council attorney. And you're coming in for a rezoning decision. Well, town council's going to get from planning a summary. And at the bottom of that summary, they're going to recommend for the reasons laid out in the report, whether to grant the rezoning or not. The difference in a BOA situation is you're going to have a summary. And that summary is going to be an exhibit, by the way. And the person that presents it is going to be a sworn witness and probably the first witness. But the recommendation is going to be very different. The recommendation is not going to be grant or deny the variance. It's going to be determine these 4 issues in a quasi-judicial hearing and make your decision. So you're not, staff's not taking a stand. And the reason they're not taking a stand is because they're going to be part of the record, and that furthers the impartiality. Well, likewise, the attorney wants to make sure that if it's appealed to court, that he's still in the driver's seat, so he's got total control from day one to whenever the judge issues his order. So for that reason, the attorney cannot participate. He's there in a very generic advisory role. For example, Mary Smith gets up and wants to participate. Chairman looks at me and says, can she? Well, I can't answer that question. But what I will do is say, well, the law says this. You may want to ask her these questions. Then the decision is up to the board. So it's very different because in a different situation, you know, I would answer that question. But in this case, and if you read between the lines, there'll be enough guidance in what I say, although I'm speaking generically, generally and neutral. If you're sharp and you remember our preparations, which again will be neutral, but you'll know where I'm coming from and you'll know what to do. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, it does. The second part of it, sometimes the person making the complaint or applying for the variance or somebody else brings their own attorney into the meeting. How do we treat that attorney?
Well, that's what I meant earlier, different board. I'll give you a good example, the daycare center situation that I had. First of all, we know several things from the beginning. We know that that the party to the hearing, let's call them the appellant or the applicant for a variance, appellant from a zoning decision. The applicant appellant has two or three sacrosanct rights. He can submit evidence and he can cross-examine. When he submits evidence, he can do it with exhibits and with testimony. So Joe Blow comes in, he doesn't know any of these things. The first one of those things will be granted because the chair will say, well, Mr. Joe Blow, what have you got to say? A smart lay person would, we'll skip that. So what I did as the attorney was I presented a summary. I told, then I called my witnesses. They were sworn in, and I direct examined them. But a lot of boards, because I can do that, I'm allowed to do that, but I've run into boards that didn't really know I could do that or were very careful about their own turf. So there had to be a very delicate balancing act. I would ask questions, but if I saw that they wanted to ask the questions, then I would back off. That becomes twice as difficult in cross-examination because most boards don't realize or conveniently forget the fact that the party or their attorney can cross-examine the adverse witnesses. And so it becomes very delicate because some boards just don't want to give up their power.
And we have had only one that I can remember in 10 years where it was an attorney presented basically the case for the plaintiff and never cross-examined anybody but just presented their case, had it all laid out, the summary and so forth as you have.
A lot of that depends on the scenario. The 120-day appellant that I spoke of earlier, his case was a dead dog from top to bottom. So there was no reason for me to cross-examine him. There's no reason to prolong the hearing. You know, half of law is the law and facts. The other half is theater and persuasion. So it was much more credible for me just to present my case in much the same way. The questions I asked my client were very few. I did everything with my exhibits, and here's my notebook, right. And when it comes time to argue, I'll walk through that notebook with you. And when the neighbor had his say, I don't think I asked him a single question. But there are times that I have asked questions, and it's just kind of a tricky balancing act. And the other thing, too, is, and here's why it's important to... Sometimes you run into time limitations. The board will slap an arbitrary time limitation on you, and that's a very difficult thing to deal with as an attorney. But the reason that I strive to exercise what I think are my prerogatives under the due process considerations is because at the end of the day, the BOA decision, if it's appealed to court, stands or falls on 100% evidentiary grounds. So if an incompetent, an adverse witness who is incompetent, that we'll talk about in a second, presents an opinion, it's my job for my client to enter an objection into the record, because I'm thinking 9 months ahead when the judge has got that record, I'm going to go in there and say, well, Mr. Property Owner was not competent to provide an opinion on the reduction of his property values. He needed an appraiser to do that. That's why I objected. Now, if I don't object, that thing sails right through judicial review. And that could be the whole case. So I have to object so I can make that argument 9 months later. Variances, you've had them before. And that's the other thing. Let me digress for a minute. Whether you're appealing a zoning decision, or you're looking for a special use permit, or you're seeking a variance, there are certain things that you have to prove. Special use permits, you don't have that in front of you because you don't do it, but they're like variances. You got to prove three or four things. Again, this language comes right out of the statute. Here's the bottom line. You have to prove these things, but you have to prove them with, here's the magic language, competent, material, and substantial evidence. And you'll find, if you had the luxury of going to four or five jurisdictions and watching quasi-judicial hearings, either by counsel or BOA, you'll find that a lot of times they don't seem much different than a public hearing. Well, is the applicant for the variance here? Yes, I am, Your Honor. I want to build. You know, he doesn't do anything legally. Just gets up, says his piece. There's no opposition, and so they grant it. Well, that ain't competent, material, substantial evidence. It's not going anywhere because there wasn't any opposition. Nobody's going to appeal it. But if a board was that informal and granted it on that basis, and there was somebody who had standing, and they appealed that, tried to participate or did participate, you know, good example. Mary Smith gets up, puts in an affidavit from her appraiser, testify, it shows pictures of heavy traffic or whatever, and the board grants the variance notwithstanding the lack of an effective showing. If Mary Smith's got the bucks and the wherewithal and she goes to court, she's got a very good chance of reversing that decision. And reversing that decision means that the judge is telling the board not to grant it, but to deny it. I mean, they gotta do what that judge says, and it's not like a rezoning where you resubmit the application, you know, 6 months later. That's it. And of course, the other important thing about a variance is, as you all know, it runs with the land. You grant it, and whoever owns the property for the rest of time. But my point is this. You've got to, if I want a variance, I've got to prove these four things with competent, material, and substantial evidence.
You said that whoever owns the property for the rest of time it doesn't go with the property owner that requested the variance and just stops there.
Now, successors in interest get the variance.
That was something that we did not know and was not ever brought out in any of our training. Let me ask this question then. If, for example, because of the unique situation that we're in with hurricanes and that kind of stuff, if we granted a variance and the structure became disabled or destroyed.
That's a great question.
Does the variance still go with that property or no?
I know what I'd have to do, but I haven't done it, so I can't answer the question. That requires analyzing two issues. First of all, I'm sure it's happened, and when you go to a law school and you go to that library, you got five floors of books. 90% of those books are reported decisions from federal and every state. Somewhere in those books, which go back to the 1800s, what you're looking for has happened more likely than not. I've never run into that situation, but I would go into that library and say, well, I gotta analyze three things. I gotta take a non-conforming situation, see if the variance, how the variance affected that, and then I've got to analyze the issue of a variance running with the property when the conditions that warrant the variance are wiped out for whatever or changed. Now, I've never run into that. I don't know the answer to that. I can find that answer, but I haven't had the joy of looking at that yet.
Many years ago, there was a house that was built on Alabama Avenue. There was a house built on Alabama Avenue. The surveyor messed up, not knowing that the right-of-way was 90 feet, and built the house within the setback.
Wow.
And it wasn't caught until they came in to get an occupancy permit, and the building inspector went, wait a minute, the footprint of this house is not right. So they came to us for variance. I mean, it was still back far enough that Alabama Avenue is probably never going to be widened, and it's never going to be a problem. So out of the goodnesses of a kiss of our heart being looking at it from a standpoint, this million-dollar house now has to be torn down. We granted the variance on that house, but we were also told, I believe, by the town attorney at that time that it only went with that property owner.
No, variance is run with the land, but I think I bet you a dollar that if I looked into that issue, I would find case law that basically says if the conditions have changed, like, if that house burned down, somebody's going to come in and get a building permit, or they've got to conform to the statute, to the zoning, when they rebuild it.
Correct.
And I can't see at all somebody coming in looking for a CO or a building permit on plans based on a variance that runs with the land that allows them to encroach into the right of way. Again, I can't cite your chapter and verse, but I know for a fact. I could find chapter and verse, but there's no way that any local government would allow a brand new building to with the old one. The conditions that justify that variance to begin with are no longer there.
So then they could, the building inspector say, no, you can't build it back in the same spot, you have to now move it back.
That'd be my knee-jerk, but again, if that issue ever came up, if that house ever was destroyed, please call me first, because that's a real interesting issue. I really would like to look at that.
All right, I'll throw a whammy on you on that one. Say the house catches on fire, more than 50% is burned. Rules are 50%, you bring it up to code. Where
right.
are you at now?
I think that... To me, that controls. But I would go into that law library thinking, reasonably optimistic, that I would find a case that says,
that I would find the law that says
all bets are off.
Bringing it up to code is required. And again, it's the interplay between non-conforming, which is controlled by the ordinance. If you, and I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, Belleville just rewrote their non-conforming provisions. And we really wrestled with value, square footage, residential versus commercial. And at the end, they just kind of copped out and rather than take a hard stand against non-conforming, they kind of made it easy for acts of God to continue. So it differs from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but I just got to think that when the conditions change and the variance is no longer warranted, that code's going to control. And I bet you the case law would say exactly that. If conditions change, there's no need for the variance. The variance is without effect. But again, that's based on 30 years' experience, and I'd have to confirm that.
I'm glad you have spoken to that effect.
So what you're saying, though, is, say, in the case of the daycare. So the daycare was granted, let's just, for instance, the daycare was granted the variance to build the daycare there. 30 years down the road, mom and the family passes away and sells the business off to another group. They're still allowed to keep that daycare there because it was already granted the variance way back. That would be a different...
Terminology is a little different. Special use permit also runs with the land.
Okay.
And the special use permit in that case would allow the operation...
to continue on?
Yeah. But the operation is... The way the what would be permitted is the way the operation was laid out in the application.
Right.
For example, if they come back and try to build a parking structure with a second deck,
it's got to stay exactly the way it was originally permitted.
And I'll give you a good example of that. I've got a very, very complicated case right now where, a special use permit was issued in the 70s to run a marina. And there were two or three major modifications that resulted in the first two modifications were to the original special use permit. And each modification enlarged the scope of operations. The fourth major modification was to put a dry stack in there. And this time, the local government put a different number on the special use permit. Everything got tied up in litigation. No building permits were pulled within a year. And by ordinance, the special use permit dissolved. So that person can't put the dry stack there, but they can still fall back on the third modification because that runs with the land, and they can still do what the third modification allowed if they hadn't been defrauded of the property and they weren't in litigation. but they're great questions, but they're questions that would require a couple of hours of research and some analysis. This is what I really want to share with you, because there's some interesting things in here. I rewrote Belleville's zoning ordinance in 2007 and then amended it recently. This is quite the contrast to your all's code. Your all's code says Board of Adjustment can do what 388 says it can do, the statute. I took the position, and you have to understand, quasi-judicial requirements were, for the longest time, a creature of case law. You know, you got statutory law that Raleigh writes, and you got case law that judges decide. And the whole concept of quasi-judicial proceedings evolved over 30 or 40 years by judges. Well, recently, the General Assembly started codifying these by putting them into a statute. And based on that codification and based on the confusion that I had experienced in, or observed in quasi-judicial hearings, Belleville's taken a very different tack. We actually spell out in the zoning ordinance, this is right from their zoning ordinance, how you do a quasi-judicial. So this is their cookbook recipe. And there's some interesting things in it. Number one, fair and impartial, determine the facts and then render a decision based on the facts, that we know that. Persons and number two, persons and entities directly affected, that's shorthand for the standing issue that we brought up earlier. Again, that's nothing you need to know about ahead of time, because that's one way that I can counsel you by still being neutral in the course of the hearing. Number three, I don't know if you realize this, but you have... Hey, Mayor. You all have the authority to issue subpoenas for a quasi-judicial hearing. Didn't know if you knew that. If you... I've never seen it happen, but you have that statutory authority. And the chairman, at the bottom of the paragraph number three... the chairman can rule on any motion to quash or modify a subpoena. In other words, I've got a hearing on Friday. I write the chairman a request to issue a subpoena for somebody that is not going to cooperate for me that I want to have there. Chairman thinks about it. He writes me back on Tuesday and says, you know, I'm going to deny that subpoena. I'm not going to issue it. I can come in front of the hearing on Friday and appeal that to the whole board, and by majority vote, I may or may not. That decision to deny that subpoena may or may not be affirmed. Witnesses, number four.
I just wait on you. We had that with
them. Did you really?
That subpoena, the mayor.
That's interesting.
And he came and presented. Right. You know, I think... As far as I remember, I was the chairman at the time. I don't remember being engaged in the process of issuing the subpoena, except for getting a call saying we've got to issue a subpoena, please sign it. I did not realise that I had...
You had some discretionary authority.
Yeah, any authority over it.
And the due process there is if I can challenge that discretionary authority by bringing the issue in front of the whole board. You might deny me. I come in on Friday and say, I really wanted the mayor. Chairman denied my subpoena. Let me tell you why, and then I'm going to ask you to vote on my request. Okay. So it can get kind of interesting. That's the first time I've heard of a subpoena, actual subpoena.
He didn't want to appear, so he was subpoenaed to appear. But yet the other part of that in that particular case was that what he was presenting really wasn't material.
Yeah, it was nothing. Really didn't add to anything with it.
Materials.
Right. Now that's an interesting point, because let's say you've got two attorneys representing, one is the applicant and one is somebody adverse to the applicant. Applicant really wants a witness, he puts the witness on, and the witness starts. And here's one of the difficult jobs that you all have to do. Witness starts talking about a lot of stuff, and this other attorney objects, not relevant, not material. The chairman has got to make a decision about, just like a judge, whether to sustain that objection or to overrule that objection. Now, there's no downside. The issue will get resolved if it goes up to court, and the judge will eventually rule on that along with all the other issues that are presented to him. So you're not going to hurt yourself, but it's kind of fun to have that authority. I mean, all of you are the judge and the jury, but the chairman runs that hearing. He's the top judge. And but you can't arbitrarily jump in. But if somebody makes an objection, you get to rule on that objection.
So when there was an objection made about some photographs in that particular mm-hmm. same case, mm-hmm. technically speaking, you could have said, you know...
He's got to rule on the objection.
Okay, so you should say, we agree with that, or I forgot the exact
word. You just do what the judges on TV do. Sustain means, yeah, your objection's
sustained
fine.
Sustained or?
Sustained, we will not, sustained, please stop talking about those photographs and don't ask any more questions about those photographs, or overruled, you may answer the question.
Okay.
Now look, you got that authority, but what downside is there to be fairly relaxed about it? I mean, don't have a free-for-all, don't let everything and anything in, but you don't have to be such a straight arrow stickler too, because it'll all get washed out.
Because if you're wrong, it gets washed out. It's
there's no downside to you. It is good to err on the side of a full-blown hearing where everybody has ample opportunity to present evidence. Because if it's serious enough, it'll go to Superior Court, and that judge will be the final say-so on the rulings and the evidence and everything. On the same token, you don't want it to be a circus. You don't want it to be haphazard. You want it to be professional. You're not going to let somebody who's going to get on a soapbox and rant and rave to have that opportunity. Thank you, sir. You may step down. So it's kind of a balancing act, but you want to err. Yeah. You want to err on giving an opportunity where that opportunity is. Common sense tells you it's a good thing to do.
What's the downside to us, you know, if the person doesn't appear?
Well, in court, it would be a compel. I think that in your case, it would probably just end up being a motion to continue. And if it keeps going on, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I'd probably go back into my statute and look for some annotations to see what kind of authority you've got to enforce a subpoena compared to a judge. The only thing I've seen so far is you got the authority to issue it. I haven't seen too much about enforcing it, so it's something that we'll have to... if we get a hot potato, we'll look at all these things before they happen. Number five, parties to a hearing may cross-examine witnesses, and members of the decision-making board may examine anyone. So you see how I kind of played it both ways there compared to what we talked about earlier. Number six, I had a local government board, gave them the roadmap, gave them the training immediately before a hearing for a variance. And they're all intelligent. They have various degrees of sophistication. They all got it. But when we got into that hearing, and the hearing went fine, your witnesses, the questions, the exhibits, the evidence, that was fine. But where they had a very difficult time conceptually was taking that evidence and making findings of fact and then applying those findings of fact to the statutory requirements like in variances 1 through 4. They just had a hard time. So literally what I had to do, again, in a neutral point was, okay, going back to the variance, board as a whole, did the applicant present evidence showing it was an unnecessary hardship if the ordinance was applied? Well, yeah, they did. Okay, is that your finding? Well, yes, it is. And then I had to walk them through it to get to the decision. I didn't push one way or another, but they needed that structure to get to the bottom line. It doesn't sound like you all did, which I look forward to. Number six, I give you all that. As we look at number six, the party initiating the application or appeal has the burden of presenting sufficient evidence for you to find facts and conclude whether the standards and requirements have been met. If evidence presented is insufficient, then that party's application or appeal shall, not may, shall be denied. That's the operation of the law. If sufficient evidence is presented showing that the standards have been met, then the initial party has to get the decision in its favor. And if not, the court's going to make you do it. here's where it gets fun. If the evidence is sufficient from both sides but conflicting, you got to weigh the evidence and then find your own facts. That's where it gets very interesting.
That gets into opinion, right?
I don't know. That word is a loaded word for me that we're going to get ready to get into in a minute. Opinion. I would answer your question this way. If you're talking about opinion evidence, hold your question in a minute and we'll discuss opinion evidence. If you're talking about what's your opinion of the evidence, I know where you're coming from. And I'm not talking down to you, I'm not being critical. But if that would be the incorrect way of expressing it. Here's the correct way of expressing it. You have to weigh the credibility of each.
Oh, okay.
And you're going to find 99 times out of 100 that one witness is more credible on the same point than the other. And you have to just weigh it. And the one that weighs the most is the one that's the most credible and the one that you'll run with when you apply the standards. Let's see if we can come up with an example. We got two neighbors. They're complaining about, let's say somebody gets cited for a public nuisance. Let's say it's because they got kennels in the backyard and the smell and conditions are atrocious. The appellant comes in and says, look, I clean those cages out every day. I'm religious about scooping up the poop. I'm very sensitive to these matters. That's his sworn testimony, okay? And it's based on his first-hand knowledge, so to speak. Doesn't get much credible than that. I mean, that's somebody coming in telling you what they do. Now, you get the neighbor comes in somehow or another, some questions are elicited, answers are elicited from her, showing that she's not biased. For example, she lives downwind from him during the summer when the breeze is predominantly from the southwest. Everybody knows that's the common breeze in the summertime. And, well, what has been your experience? Completely opposite. And a good attorney, let's say she's made complaints. Her attorney is going to present, well, did you ever complain? Well, yes, I did. Okay, let me show you this. Yeah, that's my first complaint. Here's my second complaint. Okay, now, at the end of the day, you got two conflicting sets of evidence. And they both are, without being able to prove the applicant was outright lying, they both are credible. But the neighbor's evidence weighs a lot more.
Because she actually went to downtown, filed a complaint.
Yeah. You corroborated her statements. Or you get the neighbor one step beyond her, and she comes and testifies after her neighbor, and again, you show that she's got no axe to grind. She says, yeah, I'm two houses down, and I can still smell it. Well, now you're getting some weight there that counters what the appellant was saying. No, I clean them out every day.
So paper trails do matter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I do know that firsthand. But.
Yeah, I mean, that's the name of the game.
James, I'm gonna ask a question here because it comes up more often than not in our hearings. In the past, the town has allowed things which have been a violation of the ordinance, either for neglect or they just didn't even know what was going on, or they knew and they didn't care, and it just happened.
The like town has allowed what?
Allowed violations of their ordinances. One of the big things is like a shed, for example. Mm-hmm. Ordinance says a shed has to be so many feet from the house, it has to be in the backyard.
Accessory building.
Yeah. So we have a person who wants to build a shed. They don't have enough room in the back. Uh-huh. They want to build it on the side. They have the room there. And they come in and they say, well, here I bring photographs. We've had these photograph things. Here I bring photograph after photograph after photograph of all these other outbuildings that are built this way, and the town has allowed it.
Let's go down to number 13.
Okay.
Each case must be decided on its own merits, and prior decisions are not binding upon the decision-making board.
That was told to us when this happened one time, and by our legal counsel, and we have stuck with that. And I just wanted to make sure that that was in fact.
It goes on to say, however, if a different decision is reached in a case where the fact pattern is similar to a previously decided case, then the written decision shall explain why a different result was reached. Now, why do all that? Number one, it is difficult to make a case on the local government level. Well, let's back up. Local government decisions, quasi-judicial or legislative, do not have the same effect as a judicial decision in the sense of precedent. You don't establish precedent. Your decisions in one case stand separately and apart from another case. Just because you didn't enforce the ordinance on that shed doesn't mean you cannot enforce the ordinance against this shed. You've got that right. At point two, I can only relate this. I know I'm right in saying this, but I don't know enough about it to say why. It's something that I've seen, but I've never had to get into it. It's not impossible, but it's extremely difficult for Joe Blow to make a valid case based on selective enforcement. It's extremely difficult. I couldn't tell you why, but I know that to be a legal fact. At the same time, those issues come up. And again, this to me is a difficulty that a quasi-judicial board, as an attorney, I would know enough to sift through the evidence presented on a case that raised the issue of selective enforcement. I'm experienced enough to find what I need in all that to make a valid distinction and to put that on paper. That's what you need to do. It may be difficult for some quasi-judicial boards to do that, but that, again, so what am I saying? I'm saying a couple of things. Number one, and most important of all, you got to make the decision based on the evidence and the facts in that case. Number two, you don't have precedent, and you can't. It's unfair to the applicant for you to take past experience and apply it to that case. That decision has to be made on what's presented in that case. No matter what you do, if you leave the issue of selective enforcement behind and you don't address it, you're not going to get burned by that. Because except maybe in the press or public comments, but in any judicial review of the decision that you made, past experience is not going to be a relevant factor for that judge. Now, if you want to go the extra mile, if you want to be that professional, if you want to snuff out public comments and negative media, and if you want to establish, so to speak, a precedent for doing things thoroughly, then you could take the extra step and find something in the evidence that allowed you to make a distinction between that case and the alleged selective enforcement issues that the applicant has brought up. That makes sense?
Yeah. Well, half the time I've shown you a picture of something that was so old that ordinances have changed 10 times since
right.
that was ever built. So
that's a great example, and here's where it's difficult for you. I would know, and a judge would know, to put a finding of fact saying something like this. Appellant presented exhibits, numbers 3, 4, and 5, alleged purportedly showing sheds which he contends should have been disallowed under the town ordinance. The board finds that evidence to not be credible because the appellant failed to show what times those pictures were taken and what ordinances were in effect. Now, that's
when they were even
that's
built.
A Yeah, that's a very sophisticated finding of fact. It'd be very difficult, I think, for most public bodies to think that way, and the attorney can't sit there and tell you, because it's all an open session. But that's how you deal with it. And that's a beautiful example of how you're making the distinction, but more importantly, how you're finding a fact, you're weighing the credibility, and you're putting it on paper so that you, and it helps you make the decision that you make. That's, man, if you've got a quasi-judicial board that handles it that way.
So in the case that somebody was showing you photos of sheds built,
and let me say one other thing. If you're so wise as a board that you know where they're coming from, you do not want to ask questions like, well, when were those pictures taken? you want to give yourself that ability to make that distinction.
Right. So,
you don't have the burden.
You don't use that as your defining factor.
They didn't present the evidence.
It's their,
they don't ask for it.
It's their burden to make their case.
Got it. You don't coach them along.
You don't coach them. Because, for a couple of reasons. One, you don't need to do, you shouldn't, and you don't need to do it.
Right.
Number seven is important. Basically, when I go to court, I've got two books. One is the rules of procedure, which tell me how to do all the paperwork, the motions and everything. Then I got another book that's just as thick called the rules of evidence. Hearsay, all that kind of stuff. What number seven says is that the courts have decided that the strict rules of evidence are not applicable in a quasi-judicial hearing. However, you can, if something that couldn't come into court because of the rules of evidence, it was inadmissible, you can allow it to come in to a quasi-judicial hearing because at the end of the day, you're going to weigh it. And here's a good example. If I'm in a trial and I've got an affidavit from you saying a key point, and I want to put that affidavit in because you're not there. I gave you a subpoena, you didn't show up, or you're more than 100 miles away, or you got mad at me, whatever. The minute I put that affidavit in on that key point, the other attorney is going to say, objection, hearsay. And that's because you're not there for him to cross-examine.
Right.
Now, in a quasi-judicial hearing, and again, you want to show that you're providing the opportunity. You want to have a full hearing. You may let that affidavit come in, but your finding of fact would demonstrate that you didn't give it much credibility because the affiant wasn't there for anybody else to cross-examine. Appellant offered the affidavit of Joe Blow, exhibit number 7, which the board allowed into evidence, but which the weight, the credibility thereof was found wanting because the affiant wasn't available for cross-examination. Again, pretty sophisticated finding of fact. And to the extent that I can help you in the, I would say I could coach you on that one about coaching. But just remember, we're getting into the evidentiary points, and just remember that if somebody says X and somebody says Y and Y is backed up by paper, that's more credible. If somebody says X and somebody says Y and X is based on an affidavit and the affiant isn't there to testify or be cross-examined, that's not very credible. If somebody's just repeating themselves over and over and over again without presenting any evidence, that's not very credible. And here's where it gets real interesting, and this comes out of a statute. Opinion, and let me back up. If we have a trial, one of the things that's very difficult for the average citizen in a trial that needs expert testimony is to cover the cost of an expert witness. You're looking at thousands of dollars. But the point is, in a trial, you need an expert for certain things. property value is the best example. And that'll show up in your quasi-judicial hearings all the time, property and traffic. Opinion evidence on scientific and other specialized issues, traffic safety, property values, depreciation thereof, unless offered by a properly qualified expert witness, is generally not allowed, and this comes out of the statute, and shall not be considered by the quasi-judicial board as the basis for any critical fact, finding of fact. So, Mary wants to build a daycare center. The neighbor directly across the street stands up on her own without an appraiser and says, I don't want that. It's going to tear down my property value. You will hear that time and time and time again for the rest of your tenure. You cannot base a finding of fact on her lay opinion about property depreciation because it's not competent, and the statute tells you you can't do it.
Well, so, she's a real estate agent.
Well, you still got, well, a real estate agent.
A local real estate agent.
If I was the attorney, I would say, Chairman, do you mind if I do a voir dire of this witness, which is being tendered as an expert? And I would say, what do you do for a living? I'm a real estate agent. How long have you been doing it? Have you ever appraised property? Mm-hmm. No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, when you do you work with appraisers? Yes, I do. Is that an issue of the real estate contract? Yes, I do. Do you ever perform that service? No, I don't.
Okay.
So Chairman, I would ask you not to accept this witness as an expert on the issue of property depreciation because she's not qualified to present an opinion.
So was Marissa Torme qualified or not qualified?
I might cut her some slack. So you can't have lay witness testimony about A, B, or C, how the use of one property would affect the value of another property. Very important, how the increase in vehicular traffic would pose a danger to public safety. That applicant wants to make the other party that wants to present that as an objection to granting the special use permit's got to go out, hire a traffic engineer and get a TIA, a traffic impact analysis.
I got one for you. Just that was a good question. So someone comes up and they're saying it's going to cost X amount of dollars to rebuild, and they get a guy like me as a general contractor who prices jobs every day. I would be considered an expert witness.
Yeah, you have the thing that you need to know about expert witnesses, if the attorneys or the parties know what they're doing, is you got to lay the foundation for their. You got to lay a foundation showing that they have a basis upon which to present expert testimony. Okay. So I would establish your years of experience as a general contractor, that you're licensed, that you often price out jobs, that you do blah 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 blah.
Right.
Then I would say, Chairman, I offer this witness as an expert on the cost of the repairs needed for this particular structure.
Yeah,
I went through an expert witness examination in district court for actual reconstruction and so forth.
Exactly.
Where I could testify.
Yeah, exactly.
And then all my training, all my everything was brought into play before they made that.
Because, again, the issue is in court, if the chairman allows a non-expert to testify on an issue that requires expert testimony, man, I'm going to go to that Superior Court judge and I'm going
to
hammer that all day to get that BOA decision reversed. And I've got a good shot in that case. Number 9, don't discuss the case before you hear it. Try not to gather evidence. It's hard not to drive by the property and look at it. I don't mean that literally, but I think you understand.
You can't help but drive by.
Yes, true. Decision-making board shall not... Decision-making board shall not impose an arbitrary time limit. However, the chairman may limit and prohibit unduly repetitious or irrelevant testimony. Also, if you've got a gated community where everybody that shows up is going to say the same thing, you are authorized to limit the presentation to a spokesman for that group. You don't want to be there all night. A smart attorney or a smart applicant is going to give you a paper trail. It's going to put those exhibits in. Administrative appeal staff's going to put those in. As a matter of fact, if Mr. John would be here as a witness, we would swear him in. We would ask him to give a presentation of code enforcement's of the history from a code enforcement situation, and all the paper he's got in his file is going to go in as an exhibit, which is part of the evidence that you all weigh. You got to, number 12, you got to deliberate in open session. 13, we've already gone through. You make those findings of fact and apply those facts to the standard. Sometimes, I'll just throw this out, sometimes it's easier in your head to go backwards. If you have, you listen to everything, you look at your variance requirements, you say to yourself, I don't think he proved all four of them. If you can go to the end first, and I'm not saying you say this openly, you kind of do it in your head. If you go to the conclusion first, then you can kind of work backwards and sift through the evidence, which you'll have in front of you, and kind of decide how the evidence helps or detracts from you reaching what your gut tells you the decision's going to be. Sometimes it's easier to go about it that way than to start at the very beginning and then try to figure out what the decision is. Once the decision is rendered, then the matter cannot be reheard unless conditions on the subject property have substantially changed. The minutes of a quasi-judicial hearing shall be detailed, identify the witnesses, and provide a complete summary. Audio tape shall be made at the hearing and retained by the town clerk in the event of appeal. Open meetings law statutes tell you that audio serves as minutes. So I'm not sitting there saying you got to take down exactly what everybody says. Just make sure you got a good audio recording.
We typically have a court reporter.
Yeah, that's great. I was just going to say the mm-hmm. parties have the opportunity. But that's great. Ooh, that's mm-hmm. good. That's really good. I'm impressed with that. A member of the decision-making board shall not participate or vote on any matter violating the affected person's constitutional rights to an impartial decision. Impermissible conflicts include, but are not limited to, fixed opinions, undisclosed ex parte, that's unilateral, nobody else knows about it, communications, a close family business or other associational relationship with one of the affected parties, conflict of interest as defined by statute, ordinance, resolution, yada, yada, yada. And here's the interesting thing. If an objection is raised to a member's participation and that member does not recuse his or herself with the chairman's approval, then the remaining member shall, by majority vote, vote on the objection. And if the objection is affirmed by a majority vote, then the challenged member shall be disqualified. So you all have your roll call. Somebody, one of the attorneys, heard something they didn't like. They challenge that board member's participation. They stand up, Mr. Chairman. I would ask that, what's the lady that we just talked to?
Ann Brodsky.
What's your last name?
Brodsky.
Brodsky. I'd ask that board member Brodsky be, that board member Brodsky recuse herself and says, are you kidding? You know, in her non-flappable way, are you kidding? You know, and she says no, then that's it. Unless somebody on the board also feels that she should. In other words, they can't call for the vote, but somebody on the board can. If Ann says, no, I'm going to stick around, and you think,
might jeopardize the Superior Court, right?
Well, whatever. You just think that there's something there. Well, you can make a motion to disqualify her. Now, you're going to have to say why. And I've had that happen. I've had that happen in a Board of Adjustment hearing, as a matter of fact. And the member was disqualified, and he huffed and he puffed. And we asked him to leave the room, and after a month or two, he was fine. There was a reason. I don't remember what it was, a long time ago. But there is that process. So, hopefully you got a little something out of all that. If you got any questions.
Good.
You might want to keep your hand out just for a few seconds. But I appreciate your attention.
Well, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, having the opportunity. And Miss Josie, you offered that to me, so thank you all very much. Look forward to when we have a quasi-judicial hearing.
We're not done.
I'm throwing my trash.
We're not done. For our member items.
Yeah, it's fine.
Member items.
The rest of the member items.
And we have to take another vote, election of vice chair.
Okay, so Dolores has resigned, and she was the vice chairperson.
Right.
So we need to elect the new vice chairperson. Are there any nominations for that?
Yeah, I nominate Mr. Garibay. How do you pronounce his name?
Garibay.
Since he's not here to appear.
I'll second Tony's nomination.
Okay.
He didn't show up.
Any other nominations? No.
Yeah.
Is that, okay. Let's vote on that. Everyone agree in agreement?
Aye.
Okay.
He actually agreed very well. So, yes.
Brian's 3-year term.
Oh, am I confirmed again? We just did. What did we do last time?
You
that was for the one meeting?
Well, you finished out somebody else's term.
Oh, okay.
So now you are starting your own 3-year term.
You graduated.
Okay, so
you're
now.
I am. You're relieved. Hey, I do have a quick question concerning our. I don't need to keep running on. I'm never ready to go. Okay, so everything's done, right? Everybody's given their facts and all the bickerings over with them, why they should have this and why they shouldn't have that. We have to have our discussion up there in front of everybody. We're not allowed to go. With the coaching thing, well, I guess at that point it's closed.
Let me say something else that I forgot to say. When it's all said and done, the attorney is going to, after the meeting over the next week or two, draft a written decision. What you will get in the course of a hearing is a decision worksheet. And I haven't looked at it for a year or two, but you basically list your findings and then the issues will be there and kind of like a yes or a no. Did the applicant's evidence show the following? And then you'd have variance. You got the four issues, and maybe under each issue you'd have yes or no. So there'll be an idiot guide to walk you through what your decision is, and then I go craft a 10-page decision or a 3-page decision thereafter based on that.
But my main question is the discussion is in front of everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if I'm saying one thing and
they're all done, they can't say anything else.
And at that point, this is closed.
The chairman is closed.
I mean, I remember us doing all that. I'm just
chairman will close.
It was my first
hearing.
Go-around. So.
And the problem you get is that they, when you talk,
sometimes they want to interject, and we have allowed it in the past.
Most people misunderstood
what I said. You want to say that again?
Okay.
And then we went on and said, well...
Within limits.
Okay. And that was my question. So you don't go... You're not allowed to go have a private discussion. It's got to be in the public.
Yeah.
Okay. That was my question.
Great.
Anything else? Have you covered all those items?
Okay. Covered everything.
Make a motion to adjourn.
Thank you.
Right. All right.
Thank you.
Oh, well, that was fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very informative.
Very informative.
Yeah, that was good.
Good.